I'm here today with Larry Snyder, one who knew Schaefer, I would say, extremely well, lived in the community with Schaefer at Le Bris, at the Swiss Le Bris. And today, Larry, I'd just like for you to begin to tell us when you first met Schaefer, and were you a Christian or were you not?
Can I back up just a little bit?
Yes, you may.
Make the
yes,
story
that's
more
right.
complete.
Yes.
I grew up in Ohio, broken home, lived with my mother and my grandparents in this village called New Knoxville, had an evangelical reform background. When I was growing up, liberalism came into the church, but being young, I had no idea what it was, but I didn't see any reality in the church. The church was known as one of the 10 greatest rural churches in America. Life magazine had 8 full pages. They had a tremendous educational program, one of the first of its kind in Northwest Ohio. But I grew up, had a lot of questions, talked to my pastor, and my question is it true and how do you know? And the dear pastor simply said, well, the Bible's true, it's the Word of God, and if you believe, things will be all right. Well, I didn't feel that was a sufficient answer. Went off to university, studied history, political science, liberal arts background. One of my favorite philosophy teachers was an ex-minister, so you can imagine how that impacted my thinking. By the time I graduated, I thought that Freud and Marx were probably more correct in understanding religion, that it was basically a crutch, a projection. Okay. I called a shipping company a few days before graduation, asked if they had any room on a World War II ship that they used to cater students to Europe cheaply. And they said they had one berth left. I said, I'll take it. Then I told my mother I was going to travel around the world. Of course, she hit the ceiling. But finally, she came around to understand. She gave her consent. I arrived in Europe, I bought a scooter and a pup tent, traveled all around, picked up odd jobs. And then I was up in in Oslo, Norway. And one evening, a fellow came through the youth hostel where I was staying. And I loved to talk with people, and I had a date that night, so we had about 10 minutes to talk. He was leaving the next day, and he said, there's a little place down in Switzerland you can get answers to your questions, because I love to talk with people from all over, and I got all kinds of possibility. So that intrigued me. And I wrote a letter to the Schaefers, and I found it later in the files because they kept all their correspondence. And basically I wrote and said, I've been traveling in Europe for a year. I've talked to a lot of people. I'm sort of on the fence. I don't know which way I'm going to fall. But I've heard about this little community. Could I come? And is there a possibility to get a job nearby? And I got this wonderful letter back from the Schaefers and said, you're welcome to come. We're up in the mountains, too far from a work possibility, but come by. Well, what was intriguing is that the fellow who told me, who was from Iowa, did not tell me it was a Christian community. He told me this was a community where they discuss ideas, and it would be helpful if I were able to stop by. So I went to Le Bris without understanding, and when I arrived late at night on my scooter, quickly became apparent that this was a Christian community. But the reason I stayed is because Edith Schaefer gave me a copy of the Le Bris story in manuscript form. It had not been published. She wrote it. She didn't think it would ever be published. She kept it under her bed, and Susan McCauley and Ranald were living in Beausite where I stayed, and Susan went over and asked her mother for that manuscript. I stayed up all night to read it. It was intriguing. And if you read the Le Bris story, you understand why. But it was a Christian community, and that still bothered me. And I was there for the weekend. Schaefer was away, had a Bible study in Zurich. He came back, I think, a Monday or Tuesday. I don't remember those exact dates. But something happened, unpremeditated. We met at the corner of their chalet. He came down one side, a blind side of the chalet. I couldn't see where he was. And I walked in the front of the chalet, and we met at the corner, and it was obviously Dr. Schaefer. I mean, no one would dress like like Dr. Schaefer. So it was obvious. And the first thing I said was, knowing it was a Christian community, I said, if you use a word like God or Jesus Christ, I'm going to leave. And I don't know why I said that, but that came out of my mouth. And he said, well, let's just go upstairs and talk. And he was very kind, considerate. We went upstairs to his bedroom, which was his office. And we talked probably for 2 hours. I don't remember everything that we said, but I was intrigued by the fact here was someone who cared enough about me to spend time. You know, that was the generation where everybody was talking about you being a punch card, you know, and yes, that type of a mentality. But here was somebody who cared for people, and you felt he cared for people. Now, you didn't necessarily agree with him, but where did this compassion come from? Why would he take the time to sit down and talk with me and find out something in my life story when I just appeared? So that was sort of my first encounter with Schaefer. And that first week, I almost left. Went to a prayer meeting, and if I heard the word prayer, it would rankle me. We were next door in a chalet for handicapped people, which some Christian ladies started.
Yes.
And fortunately, I was in the back row because I was going to leave, but it was too awkward, so I stayed. But then the Saturday night discussions were absolutely fascinating. Never met someone in the Christian faith who would be able to talk about cultural issues. You know, church, you talk about the Bible and Bible history and missions and things like this. But here was someone who not only talked about the Bible, but he talked about art and painting and film and music, all from a certain perspective, in a most wonderful way. And that blew my mind. So I decided, I'm going to stay. This is so intriguing. And I remember we had students, I think, there from maybe Wellesley or one of the other colleges. So everybody was asking intriguing questions, you know? And there was Schaefer in his living room, sitting on this red hat, this CD made out of a barrel painted red, by the fireplace, and answering questions in the wee hours of the morning. It was fascinating. People were laying on the floor, you know, some people might have been asleep, but they were all there, and it was such an intriguing time. So that encouraged me to stay. And I think growing up in this church, I had enough of a biblical vocabulary that suddenly when he began to explain possibilities to philosophical questions, something began to click. And suddenly I saw the biblical truth in a different light. And at some point within that first month, I really accepted the Lord. Before that, I would have said I've known something about biblical truth, but I don't ever remember hearing a sermon that had to do with salvation or personal transformation or the importance of Christ and why you must believe. We heard a lot of things about the social gospel, I don't ever recall hearing a sermon. Now, maybe there was, and I wasn't listening, okay? So that was very intriguing about LaBrie. And then I stayed 13 months. And by the time I left, I decided I was not going to do graduate work in international relations, but I wanted to do some theological studies. And that's when I went up to Holland with some people who were returning to Holland, and walked the docks of Rotterdam to find a ship to sail back to the States on. And finally somebody said, look, Rotterdam's the largest harbor in the world. What you need to do is go to the consulate and wait until a captain comes in asking for papers so that his seamen could go ashore. And then you can ask him if you could work on the ship. And that's what I did. So there's a Norwegian ship going back to the States, New Orleans, asked the captain, sure, you can work, and I'll pay you $1, a legal requirement, I think, and arrived in New Orleans, and then took a bus up to Ohio, and then eventually went to St. Louis.
And where did you do your theological training?
At Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. Yep.
And this is roughly what year?
I left in 60. This would have been 65.
Oh, so this is really relatively early on. I mean, LaBrie starts in 55.
Yeah.
The Wheaton Lecture is 65.
Right.
Which kind of put Schaeffer at least somewhat on the map here in the United States.
And those Wheaton Lectures were then published into book form.
That's correct.
Transcribed and then...
That's right. What? That became the book, The God Who Is There.
Right.
And that seemed to... Although I think Schaeffer was not well accepted among some of the evangelicals in America.
Right.
Because of the time, he had long hair.
And some of the subject matter he talked about?
Yes.
It was... some of the subject matter was offensive or out of bounds, or
yes.
You don't talk about the existentialist, but Schaeffer did.
Yes.
Because he saw it's a part of our culture. We have to understand it if we're going to address people who are caught up in these ideas.
So you come home, you go to Covenant. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you get an MDiv.
Yes.
And do you then return to?
Well, what I did before I graduated from Covenant, I was married. Nancy and I went back for a year. Because in those days, I don't know if they still do, we stretched it to 4 years because the third year you did a year of internship.
Right.
So you understand that. And so we went back for a year, mm-hmm. and we were in a chalet next to the Schaeffers. Mm-hmm. Chalet that LaBrie rented. We had 30 girls live with us in one chalet. Two bathrooms, one for us and one for them. It was a hilarious time, let me tell you. But anyhow, that was and our first son was born there. So, but it was a wonderful time, and we just thought, okay, we've given a year, we'll go back and finish, and the Lord can bring somebody else to LaBrie and take on the responsibility. So, that's what we were thinking in our mind. And I came back, finished a year. Not sure what we were going to do. Wasn't particularly interested in church at that time. This was before the PCA church. It was the Evangelical Synod. I can't remember the mm-hmm. technical name. A lot of small churches, but I wasn't particularly interested in church. I picked up some odd jobs. And then one day I came back from work, and Nancy and I had both been praying, and the Schaeffer said, you know, if you'd love to come back, you know, you're welcome to come back. But we had thought, you know, 1 year was sufficient. And then we both decided, I think we should apply to LaBrie again. And we did. And at that time, Debbie Nuda were moving out of Les Sapins, and they needed somebody to step in. And so we went back. And again, thinking, you know, it's maybe 2 or 3 years, and we'll see what happens. But it ended up being 18.
18 years. So you were living in that community with the Schaeffers. Well... you tell me, when you first met him, what stands out in your mind, that here's a man who is concerned about you as an individual, willing to spend a couple of hours with you,
yeah.
didn't know you before that encounter, and why would he be doing this? So now as you spend 18 years living in that close proximity, so tell me, what else do you remember about the man?
Okay.
And you can even talk about Edith some as well. Okay, I mean, because sure. I realize they're the both
yeah,
together.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. I think what captures best Schaeffer's compassion and his love for truth was shortly after Nancy and I were married, Schaeffer had a dialogue with Bishop Pike in Chicago.
Yes.
Nancy had never met Dr. Schaeffer, so I thought this would be a good opportunity for her to meet him. And we can be at the dialogue. This must have been in January, early 68, something like that, 1968. Terribly cold day in Chicago. Wind was blowing snow into our hotel room. We walked over to the Roosevelt Hotel. It was a huge auditorium. How many people? I'm not sure. 500 people, maybe. There could have been more, I don't recall. We sat about third way down, and so, you know, we could, fairly close to Schaeffer and Pike, Bishop Pike. And the dialogue was, the theme was, does biblical Christianity have any relevance in the 20th century? Which in itself, you know, especially back in the 60s, was a very, very hot topic. And there was a moderator. He introduced the topic. And I remember Bishop Pike spoke first, and he was wearing his garb, and he had a big cross hanging around his neck. And what struck me about his introductory remarks, he was sort of, in a joking way, playing up to the audience, you know. Very interesting fellow. The audience, I remember when Schaefer came on stage in his knickers and, you know, his outfit he wore, you could sort of sense there was some chuckling. And even before the debate, you could hear people say, well, who is this Schaefer? You know, you could hear that in the background. Then Schaefer was asked to speak, and at some point, you could sense a change in the audience. In the sense they began to listen what he had to say. And it was a palpable thing. It's hard to describe. But what he had to say was resonating in a way with people. Well, anyhow, they had the debate. I mean, they had the dialogue. They each spoke two or three times, and then there were questions from the audience. And then the moderator said, well, it's time to close. And then Bishop Pike said, I mean, this was so amazing. Bishop Pike, this is unpremeditated. He said, could I say something? And this always happens to me when I think about this. But he said, these are almost his exact words. He said a few things. They said that I have been in many debates, but this is the first time I feel like I'm treated as a human being. Well, that to me encapsulates something of Schaefer's compassion. And then, interestingly enough, after the dialogue was formally closed, they pulled the curtains, and Schaefer was on one side behind the curtains, and Pike was over here. And I went up with Nancy, and there were maybe, I don't know, 20 people around Schaefer. Finally, I had a chance to introduce him to Nancy, and then Schaefer glanced over here, and here was Bishop Pike, and I think the two or three people. Mm-hmm. And he went over. And a relationship between those two developed, so much so that Bishop Pike invited the Schaefers to come to his study center in California, and he was invited to come to Le Brie. And then he went, his second marriage, he and his wife were in Israel. You know, they had the incident where the Jeep broke down. His wife stayed with the Jeep. He tried to find some help, and he died. But he was going to come to Le Brie afterwards. Hmm. But, you know, just seeing Schaefer relate to this person in a dialogue and having that response, it was just not only unexpected, I don't know how to say it. It was just, you felt this deep love for Schaefer and his compassion, which you hope that you would be able to replicate in some way, just as you relate to people.
Yeah, one of the things that comes to me, that, and I don't know that you'd be able to answer this, because along my years, I've met some very nice people who are Christians. And I think in the back of my head, I'm sort of thinking, I wonder if they were this nice before they were Christians. So I'm wondering, as you look at Schaefer, do you think these are things, first of all, surely his Christianity influenced him. Do you think these are sort of things that he intentionally cultivated in his life, or do you think they just came natural to him?
I don't think they came natural. And the reason is this. I've met people that were in his original congregation, first congregation, or maybe the second church, I can't remember. So they knew Schaefer then, and they knew Schaefer after Labrie was started. Not that he was a totally different person, but he was much more argumentative. I'm going to win the debate. In fact, Schaefer often says in the debates he would, you know, that he had before, he would never lose. But he would, he always knew you would lose the person.
Yes.
And at some point he resolved never to call it a debate. That's why it was called a dialogue. But these people and that were members of his first church said, yeah, you know, he did learn over the years. And even in the Saturday night discussions, oftentimes we'd pray at the end, he would say, Lord, if I've said anything that's wrong, you know, help me put things right.
Yes.
So that was constantly in his mind, I think. Now, he wasn't perfect. I mean, you know, none of us are.
Right.
But that mentality, he learned, I think, from some of the mistakes he made. And you know, he didn't want to make those same mistakes again.
When he was discussing with maybe on the Saturday nights, when students would, somebody would ask a question. As you think about that, how would he go about answering those questions? Obviously not the particulars. I'm just, how would he go about doing that?
I think he had a real gift in listening to people and listening to the questions behind the questions. And when you're in a Saturday night discussion in the chapel, and maybe there would be, this was after the chapel was built.
Yes.
And you might have, on a weekend, you might have 100 people there. So you have 100 people and one individual ask a question. You're always impressed by the fact that he would speak to that person as though he were the only person in the room. Now, having said that, we were all listening, okay, and appreciated what he had to say. But he also was listening to the questions behind the questions. So his answers were also rather extensive answers. He would sort of maybe paint a broader picture, helping people to see where ideas came from. And then eventually he would maybe focus on that one question if it was necessary. But his answers were usually an enlarged, much wider answer than mostly people would expect somebody to give, you know? You know, 2 and 2 is 4, okay, but then he would go on to speak about, well, it wasn't a good example, but let's say, as an example, somebody would ask, when did the Reformation begin? Some people say October 31st, maybe not, but October 31st. Well, he would have painted a much larger picture. You know, what were the ideas? What was the church like? Why did he do this? So that would be a part of his answer.
I think, and I'm just doing some writing and thinking about my own life, and of course Schaefer had a profound influence in my life, not probably the same ways that those of you who actually were around him, but from reading the books. But as I was writing, thinking my own history, and wondering why was it that escape from reason and then how she would then live, why did it impact me so much? Mm-hmm. And then I just looked at my own life after that, and I realized I saw the importance of what we would call intellectual history, mm-hmm. that ideas, as Richard Weaver said, have consequences, and that an idea doesn't just fall out of heaven.
Right.
It doesn't fall out of the clouds like rain. They come from somewhere, and that's one of the things that I learned from Schaefer.
Yeah.
And then had it reinforced along the way, but it was Schaefer that opened my my eyes to that. So what are some of the first things, do you think, if you can think back at that time, that really influenced you beyond what you've already said?
That influenced me.
Yes, and listening to Schaefer, yes.
Okay, he gave a lecture called, shortly after I was there, I guess he gave it many times in Labrie, Basic Answers to Possible Philosophical Questions. you know? And I remember him giving the lecture and thinking, this man, when he said, if you listen to me, you can save yourself 20 years of studying history, this is arrogant. I said, what are you doing? But as I thought about that, I thought, you know, he's really right. He's really right. And what he did, he was able to sort of weave together basic ideas. And I had studied some philosophy. And you study this person's, but some of you don't see all these connections very well. And he was able to do that. I still remember him in front of the blackboard trying to describe nothingness. You know, he draw a circle and he wipe the circle out, you know, to emphasize that point. But the whole thrust of that lecture suddenly brought to clarity a lot of the confusion in my mind. Because when you're younger, go to university, most of us are very eclectic. You know, we have some knowledge maybe of the Bible, some knowledge of history, you know, and we take these courses, but we pick and choose, and we don't see whether it's coherent, what's inconsistent. We don't see that. We're not wise enough, you know. And Schaefer was able to point these things out. Well, suddenly everything began to fall into place. And so I've always looked back on that lecture and saw it as just a wonderful introduction to what I felt now I had to oftentimes unlearn what I learned at university. Yes. Because I didn't have that worldview approach that was so helpful.
Some have made comment then said, well, yeah, but he made mistakes along the way. And I think those of us who have an appreciation, and I want to know what you think, those of us who have an appreciation for Schaefer would not probably say, oh, you're wrong, but that Schaefer did something that opened the evangelical mind like nobody, because he did do it with a broad brush,
Very broad brushstroke. Very broad, but basically right.
Yes, yes.
And there are details. I remember early times, early history of Libri, we were talking about Kierkegaard. And I think at that point, Kierkegaard was seen primarily in a negative light, for whatever reason. I don't think many of his works were translated into English. And the few that were, I remember a book by Lowry and somebody else. But anyhow, there weren't many books written by Kierkegaard. And I think Kierkegaard was also put into a corner. I mean, you know. But I remember the discussion, and somebody, I don't know who the person was, who had known Kierkegaard better, began to argue with Schaefer, and Schaefer began to say, well, you know, I hadn't thought about that. So that openness was a little, that was encouraging. And I think this also happened in a couple of other areas as well. I think, you know, that probably a lot of evangelicals in the 20s and the 30s probably viewed the founding of America almost in a simplistic way.
Yes.
And I think Schaefer probably grew up with that.
Yes.
And then I think a more nuanced understanding developed. So I think I saw a change there as well. So, you know, there are areas where I think if you presented some ideas and could argue your ideas and had some type of documentation, I mean, yeah, he's willing to discuss things.
This is to start a conversation about something. So I would first ask, in his writings, I think probably the most references are in he is there and he is not silent. But the reference is to Michael Polanyi and this idea that reacting to scientism, that we can have confidence that we're right.
In reacting to scientism?
Yes.
Okay.
And that we could have, we could not have absolute epistemological certainty, but that we could be, if I were to say it philosophically, that we would be within our epistemic rights to claim, I know it is true, even though you weren't claiming absolute epistemological certainty. Would you say that is right of Schaefer or not?
Yes, I don't think he would say absolute epistemic certainty. trying to think of maybe some conversations. I never heard him say, well, I shouldn't say this because maybe he misspoke once or twice. I think he would be in agreement with that. I remember him speaking about Pliny, I think in a lecture, I can't remember what, in a very favorable light, when there weren't many people speaking about that.
Yes.
You know, Pliny was one of the first, I think, who really was able to crack open that door.
He was.
Yes. So, I'm not sure how he even heard of Pliny, or maybe just a discussion around the table. I think Schaefer learned a lot of things from discussions as people sat at the table.
Yes.
They had their areas of expertise, like I told you about this fellow with Kierkegaard.
Yes.
Well, he learned a lot at the table, I think. He was able to also share a lot of things. But there was this very interesting discussion taking place.
Mm. Let's move a little bit then to... I'm just assuming that we both think that Schaefer was apologetically a very effective witness for Christ.
Yes. Cultural apologetics.
Yes. Particularly one-on-one, but maybe in a larger group like Saturday Nights. So why do you think he was so effective?
Why was he so effective? I think it was a combination of the content... Mm-hmm. And the compassion. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to make it very brief.
Yes.
I think those two things together. I don't recall anyone, a Saturday night discussion, who might have disagreed with Schaefer, who would not have said he was a very compassionate person. Mm. So when you bring those two things together, it's something very powerful the Holy Spirit uses.
Yes.
It's something really very powerful. You know, again, it's what is this rooted in? For him, it's rooted in the fact that he knew in his bones that everyone's made in the image of God. Not only is God there, but everyone's made in the image of God, and everybody is significant. So when you relate to someone, like when he met me, he didn't know me from Adam, but he knew I was someone made in the image of God.
Yes.
And he knew that maybe I had struggles, and I had a story, and he was interested in that story. Not just because he wanted to chalk up, you know, I've talked to another person. That was the furthest thing from his mind. But simply the person in front of you, made in the image of God, if this person doesn't understand truth and who God is, you know, there are consequences. You know, so that was so, what should we say? It's like you fall in love with your wife. You don't have to ask your wife every 10 days what's her favorite flower. You know.
Right.
You don't have to ask God in prayer, is this person important? You know he's important, you know? And so I think that in the compassion for individuals.
Do you think some of his compassion also arose not only from the fact that one was made in the image of God, but that he took the fall very seriously?
Yeah, he took the fall very, very seriously. I think that's one reason he was so compassionate. He understood where people were. You know, it's like he understood people were locked in this room and couldn't find their way out. Well, he that's where people are, and he knew that in his bones. So he related to people like that. And Edith did too.
Yes.
Dear Edith, you know, she just had this love for people. Mm-hmm. And both of them sacrificed a lot.
Yes.
They sacrificed a lot. But they also made us feel not only loved, but they made us feel that we were to be honored. They would share Christmases with whoever was, you know, in the chalet at the time. Edith would stay up all night, and she would make little presents and wrap them, and they would come in the stocking, and, you know, she went out of her way. And she was saying people are important, just like when she would set a table. In Le Brie, we never ate off of plastic plates, paper plates. We never had plastic utensils. Took more time to wash the dishes, but she was making a statement. This is a beautiful setting. She put flowers on the table. The setting would be beautiful. How she served the meal, how she put, you know, if oftentimes we weren't served family style, if it was a larger group, she would do everything in the kitchen, then it would be served to you. Mm-hmm. just was more convenient, and
yes,
there wasn't enough room otherwise. But how she put the green beans on the plate, where the potatoes went, where the chicken went, it was to be a beautiful thing. Mm. And that's,
yeah,
you know, that's how they were.
So, Larry, if we're looking at Schaefer, he'd live in a different time mm-hmm. than we live. It seems like more people were asking questions, young people were asking questions, or they understood their lostness,
yeah.
and so they were trying to find a way out yeah. of this maze they call life and all that was going on, particularly in the 60s. And it seems that many people aren't asking a lot of questions. They think they have all the answers. Yeah. So what do you think we learn from Schaefer as we go about our lives today as Christians to make some impact for the gospel?
I think one of the things that we can learn for Schaefer, family is important, community is important. Doesn't have to necessarily be the church, but mm-hmm. community is important. Well, I hear Dick was like salt and light. He's mm-hmm. salt and light.
Mm-hmm.
For Schaefer, he would, I think, undoubtedly try to tease out what that meant today, mm-hmm. would mean today. What does it mean to be salt to light in mm-hmm. the postmodern world? What does it mean to be salt and light in a world today where students are so confused and they're feeling they're hurt and they need to find a safe place and they're so confused? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you relate to people? I think he would put a great emphasis. We have to creatively think about ways. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe church is not the most convenient place to bring people. Maybe we need to find another way to meet people, another place, another venue. Something that he did, and I don't know how it would work out today. But oftentimes, if he was speaking in a place and after he finished, and there were no questions, what he would do, he would ask the questions. And I think that's what we need to do. Now, how do we ask the questions? Maybe through parable, some creative story. But I think we need to ask the questions that sometimes are just lodged in these people's minds. And either they don't know how to ask the question or they're just confused. But I think these ideas, we're all made in the image of God. And so somewhere in that hole, that people, that vacuum, you've got to be able to sort of disturb that a bit, you know? I know one thing that Dick used to say, you have to be able to sort of, parables like lobbing little grenades, you know? Mm-hmm. And after a while, you get people to think. Well, this is what Christ did. I think we've got to learn to do that as well. So I don't know yes. all that he would say. I mean, he would analyze the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he would show that it has certain roots. Ideas have consequences. Yes. And maybe today that's a greater opportunity. You know, people are caught up in selfishness, and me first, greed. Okay, why is this true? Well, there are ideas, and ideas have consequences, and these are the consequences. So he would begin to expound all these things, and I think that would be... Mm. That would be very helpful. Now, in Labrie, I think he had a captive audience because yes. people came there
sure.
and they wanted to study. So, you know, it was a captive audience in some ways, but there's no reason why we can't apply some of these things to our culture today.
Well, last thing, you've given me a message that you heard him... It wasn't a message. It was a discussion time. Any story, an event
yeah.
that sticks out in your mind that says something about the man.
Okay. Yes. I don't know if people know that Dr. Schaefer had dyslexia.
Yes.
Okay. It was terribly difficult for him to write correctly, to spell correctly. Even to pronounce certain words.
Yes.
Very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
in spite of dyslexia, he trusted God enough to speak in certain situations where, if you were to mispronounce a word or misspell a word, you'd never be invited back. I mean,
right.
But through what he said, oftentimes people then stood up and listened. You know? So in one sense, they dismissed this disability he had because of what he had to say. But the other thing is that he would come to seminary, give a course of lectures, preach in the chapel. Our homiletics professors, who were trying to teach us sort of a proper way to,
yes.
to give a sermon, proper introduction, main thoughts, support it, you know, all the years. Okay. They were sort of aghast when Schaefer would come because he just didn't preach by the book. And I would contrast this with some people who would come as guest preachers and they would, a perfect sermon.
Yes.
According to everything in a homiletics textbook. He didn't remember a thing. I mean, maybe a little, but you wouldn't really remember what he had to say. Schaefer came, spoke with passion, didn't forget what he said. Yeah, that was a very interesting experience to see that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Larry, for sharing some of these things. Because I think these are things that maybe go unnoticed
yeah.
as we talk about Schaefer. Everybody thinks of him as a great intellectual and, you know, having this great ability, but there was a man mm-hmm. that was there.
Yeah.
And so thank you. Really appreciate it.